Bright Minds, the podcast from the John Adams Institute, is brought to you by the members of the John Adams. Why not become a member yourself, or even better, a patron, and enjoy all the extras and benefits? Find out more at john-adams.nl, john-adams.nl, and click on Become a Member. From Amsterdam, this is Bright Minds, the podcast from the John Adams Institute, a treasure trove of the best and the brightest of American thinking. Paul Theroux is one of the world's greatest travel writers, and if you'd like to become one too, he has this advice.
Leaving home is essential. Go alone. Travel light. Bring a map. Go by land. Flying isn't really travel. It's sort of transferring to a place. The travel begins when you arrive. Walk across a national frontier. It could be Mongolia into China. It could be Ethiopia into Kenya. Wherever it is, walking across.
When Paul Theroux came to Amsterdam back in 2011 to speak at the John Adams and tell his tales of travel, he also wanted to talk about other writers, from Hemingway to Dickens, from Nabokov to Twain to Graham Greene. Many of the world's greatest writers were also great travel writers. The Tao of Travel is a collection of travel stories. Some are his, some are from others. All are engaging tales full of exciting places and unique travel advice. And it has to be said, he does this in a kind of highly entertaining stream of consciousness that delighted our Amsterdam audience back in 2011. So here's Paul Theroux.
I'm delighted to see you here, and it's a pleasure to be in Amsterdam again. Someone asked me today about living in London. And they said, what did you like about living in London? I said, one of the things I liked about living in London was it was near Amsterdam. And I could get here quite easily. And through the 1970s, the British Council, although I'm an American, I was living in London, the British Council didn't discriminate against Americans. And they had a program of inviting speakers. So I came. And I've given a talk, I mean, through the 70s and 80s, I gave a talk in many, not just Amsterdam, many provincial places, Eindhoven, Arnhem, and Rotterdam, and all over. And I came, and I was staying in the hotel, the Ambassade, where I'm staying today, stayed in that hotel. But it was usually in the winter, and cold winters, as I recall, with ice and not snow, but it was cold, and I found it very stimulating. I love this city. I'm delighted to be back. You're lucky that you live here. And if I didn't live in Hawaii, I might join you. Anyway, seriously, there are certain... one of the things that travelers do is they look for a great place to live. And, you know, one of the hidden motives of traveling. You must know it yourself. You go to... I don't know, go to California, you go to Spain, you go wherever, and you think, I wonder if I could live here. Maybe this would be a place. Maybe, and then, of course, you come back to Amsterdam and you say, I feel at home. I'm going to talk a little bit about travel in general, about the travel book, but I was also going to add that my early experience with Holland was with Dutch priests in Central Africa. But missionaries get a bad rap. Sometimes, oh, he's a missionary, or they're missionaries. Well, the missionaries of the 1950s and 60s, these men left Holland. Several were from Amsterdam, several of the men that I knew. And they had come, when I said, how did you get to Nyasaland? Because it was called Nyasaland before it became Malawi. They said, we came down the Nile, left Amsterdam, went to Alexandria, Cairo, came down the Nile through the Sudan and then through Uganda, Tanganyika then, and into Nyasaland. And they ran schools and hospitals, and they had churches, of course, but they were very funny. One was named Father Utame de Groot. And I used to see Father Utame in the morning at breakfast, because when I wasn't teaching, we had to do something useful. So I volunteered at this hospital in the bush, and Father de Groot said, I said Mass this morning. I said, do many people show up at Mass? He said, we had one this morning. So you took one person. He said, it'll improve. It'll improve. He wasn't worried. They weren't there to make converts. He said, we're showing people by example. If you're a good person, you're working, we hope that they'll be good people and they'll work. And one day, this was in Mua Mission, in a place called Ntakataka, on the lake shore of Lake Nyasa, which came Lake Malawi. And a Canadian priest arrived. And for a week, the priest arrived. He was very agitated. He was saying prayers. And the Dutch priests were around the table. And I remember in the evening, they played cards. And they were playing cards. And the Canadian priest was walking back and forth in a very agitated way. And then when it got dark, we were playing. I can't remember what game we played. It might have been whist. But anyway, we were playing cards. And the out of the darkness, from the village, serious drumming and a dance. It's called the Niao dance. And I later found out it was called the Niao dance. And the Canadian priest looked at the Dutch priest. He said, did you hear that? And the priest was playing cards. He said, yes, Father, there's still a lot of work to do. Just playing cards. It was great. So I thought, and they were men who died there. You never said, when are you going back to Holland? They just worked and they died and they're buried there, you know, and God bless them. So when people have this knee-jerk reaction of, I hate missionaries or missionaries are corrupting people, I always think of them mellow, card-playing, easygoing, and very, very good linguists. And I knew several who were compiling dictionaries who were, you know, I learned the language there and I still speak it more or less. And it was because of men like that. So it's a compliment to them. And I think to this culture. I'm going to talk about travel in a general way. Hans mentioned this book. It's called The Tao of Travel. As you know, I've spent a lot of my life either traveling or writing about travel. And it was 10 years, though, before I went to Africa in 63, but I didn't set off to write about travel until 1973. So 10 years, I was thinking about where to go, what to do. And I realized that travel is a deliberate act. Writing a novel is a deliberate act. Joseph Conrad said that writing a novel is like making a colony. You build it up, you build up effects. You don't just scribble. It's not automatic writing. You do it. It's a very deliberate thing. You set out to do it and you do it and you plan it bit by bit. I mean, I think the great novels are written that way, not with an excess of design, but thinking clearly about what you want to do. And I think that's true of travel. Although when I first went to Africa, the first job I had was in Italy in early 1963. And then I went to Africa. I read travel books, and the travel books that I read were pretty dull. They were sometimes husband and wife books of, you know, going to a place and faintly ridiculing the place, or they were over-dramatized. What really impressed me about how bad a book might be was if you read a travel book and then you go to the place, you realize how insufficient the book is. So there was a book by, you know who Lawrence Vanderpost is. Lawrence Vanderpost lived in London. He wrote about the Kalahari. Some of his work is quite good, but a very early book of his called Venture to the Interior. And Venture to the Interior is a bit like Heart of Darkness, or at least intentionally so. And when I read it, I was quite impressed. But that was before I went to Africa. When I went to Africa, it's about climbing Mount Melange, doing a survey of Mount Melange in southern, it's in southern Malawi. And when I went there, I climbed Mount Melange and I was sort of thinking, you know, what's the big deal? I remember when I lived in Singapore, people used to say, Lee Kuan Yew has a double first from Cambridge. Whoa, you know, it's amazing. What a brain. He's got a double first from Cambridge, which is quite impressive until my son went to Cambridge and got a double first. And I thought, what's the big deal? You know, then I realized, well, Lee Kuan Yew can't be that smart. My son did that. And it wasn't my son, Louis, who you may know is on television. It was my other son. Louis went to Oxford. He got a first too. So Then I went to Africa and I saw, and I went to Mont Melange and I thought, this is amazing. I read this book about A Venture to the Interior, and it's melodrama. It's fudging it. It's not, the landscape isn't quite there. It's sort of, as the English say, over-egging it, the description. So I thought, I definitely don't want to write a travel book, because if that's what a travel book is. And it wasn't until I read the travel books that I loved and could relate to that I thought, maybe I could do that, or maybe there's something in it. And it was, the first one that impressed me was Anthony Trollope, The West Indies and the Spanish Main. No, you wouldn't have thought that's a great subject, but it was written in 1860. And Anthony Trollope, English novelist, was a surveyor for the British Postal Service. He invented the pillar box. You know the red pillar box that people put letters in? He invented it. He designed it. In London, you see a red postal box. So that was one of his contributions to British culture. And he was also a great novelist, a wonderful novelist. Also, his mother was both a novelist and a travel writer. Trollope's mother went to America in, I would say, let's say the 1830s, say 38, something like that. And she went to Cincinnati. She had a bazaar. It was called a penny bazaar. And it was a failure. And she wrote a book called The Domestic Manners of Americans. And she really disliked everything about American culture. It was a highly critical book about how Americans went around spitting. They spit all the time. She said, I hate their hats. I hate the way they spit. She said, they're always talking about freedom and they have slaves. They always talk about freedom of speech and they punish people for it. She said, Americans live in direct contradiction to all the things that they say they're great at, you know, freedom, equality. And she said, and they're not equal at all. They subjugate their people. And she went on in that vein. Mark Twain loved this book, by the way. So The Domestic Manners of Americans, I actually quote a juicy part of it in this. And she became a novelist. Her son, Anthony, became a novelist and wrote The West Indies and the Spanish Main. And because he's a novelist, the book is full of rich description and wonderful dialogue. And it's also funny. And even as much as that, what impressed me was that when he set off to write the book, he describes in the first page how he's on a ship writing, I'm setting off and I'm beginning this book. And then he goes through and he describes the places, Trinidad, Cuba, Jamaica, Nicaragua. And he describes them, which is the West Indies, then the Spanish Main, which is sort of Central America. And at the end, the last page of the book, he says, and now my ship is back in England. We're about to dock. And that is the end of this book, end of book. So he wrote the book as he was traveling and finished it when he finished the trip. And all his abilities as a novelist were invested in this wonderful narrative. You wouldn't have thought it's a natural, but it really is, and it's funny. Dickens wrote travel books. You might think, well, these are rather arcane. Charles Dickens, Anthony Trollope, you know, what about, you know, I don't know, another traveler. I don't know, Captain Scott, say. What about Captain Scott? Well, no. Captain Scott, as a matter of fact, was not a great writer. And Scott's diaries were published, but Scott was kind of a strange guy. Again, I mentioned him here because one of my topics is travelers who are very neurotic. And one of Scott's men described him as someone who cried more easily than any man he had known, and who was such a terrible leader that leadership was a martyrdom. But he cried. Imagine you're going to the South Pole and you hear someone weeping, and it's Captain Scott, the hero. Oh, God. Well, he didn't make it back from the pole. So Dickens, so a lot of the classics of travel, in other words, very kind of Hans to say that the Great Railway Bazaar was revived the travel genre, but there are plenty of books that are better than that. And when Dickens went to America, a lot of these English travelers did. Trollope went to America. His mother went to America and wrote about it. Dickens went to America and wrote about it. And Dickens always did very interesting things when he traveled. First, he traveled when his books were not selling or when he was getting bad reviews. And he went to America, and his normal way of traveling was to go and visit prisons. And so Dickens was in New York, and you would have thought, it's Charles Dickens. He'd visit the mayor. He'd, you know, wine and dine. Well, he did do those things, but he visited the Tombs, a big prison in New York. And he talked to prisoners, and he talked to the prison guards. And there are long pages of dialogue and description about the prisons, how awful they are. And the book is also about, he touched the same subjects that Fanny Trollope and Anthony Trollope did, which is the hypocrisy of the mid-19th century. Then Dickens went to modern Chuzzlewit. Modern Chuzzlewit was getting very bad reviews, so his writing was going badly, so he went to Italy, took a year off. There's a bit in this book from that. And he visited prisons, and he went to a beheading, guillotining. And so there's about, I'd say it's about, it could be 6 or 8 pages of Dickens going to an execution in Italy, in Rome. A man who killed a woman traveler, and he was found. And he describes the man, he describes the crime, the circumstances of the crime. He describes the crowd. He describes the man being led to the guillotine and the coup de grace. He describes everything. I have a little a passage from it here. And I was thinking, when I read these books, I thought, this is the stuff. Dialogue, description, drama. Rather than visiting museums, visiting churches, these people did what V.S. Pritchard described as, instead of architecture, human architecture, looking at human architecture, the way people live, how they look, what they do, the way they talk. And because they're novelists, the people that I've mentioned are novelists, they were able to reproduce dialogue. Another book that influenced, me, but you know, in the same vein, but more recent than that, while I was still sort of floundering around writing novels, was V.S. Naipaul's An Area of Darkness, which I'm sure a lot of you who are, I'm sure you're travelers and obviously you're readers or you wouldn't be here. You've read, you know what I mean? You know who Naipaul is, and you know, I wrote a book about him, and he was a friend of mine. And Area of Darkness is a wonderful book about India, and it has the qualities that a novelist would give a travel book. Vivid description, puts you in the picture, characters described in the round so that you can see them, you can smell them, you can hear them, and their voices. So I thought, well, if I ever write a travel book, it's going to be that. It's going to have dialogue, description, humor, and also I'll be candid about how I feel. Am I having a good time? Am I having a bad time? And a novelist writing a novel is often working toward a conclusion of which he or she is unaware. So I said it's a very deliberate act, but also as you're writing, you're not quite sure where you're going. And with a travel book, you know where you're going. The novel, you're sort of groping in the dark. And I saw that the great virtue of the travel book was that you know how the thing is going to end. At the same time, you're accumulating perceptions, observations that may not make a lot of sense to you at the time. To give you an example, I wrote a book about China. I went to China in 1986. I had gone in 1980. Now that seems a long time ago, over 30 years ago. At that time, the Chinese wore blue suits and had slippers and they were walking around. I was even thinking, I was writing The Mosquito Coast at that time. And I thought, people were saying, this is the next superpower. And I thought, take the crack pipe out of your mouth. You are not, this cannot be true. I cannot believe muddy blue suits, still pictures of Chairman Mao, crazy slogans on the wall. And I thought, it will never happen. Or if it happens, it will be the highest stage of poverty. In other words, very well organized, very poor, ragged, but people feeding themselves with the bare necessities, you know. So I was wrong about that. Except that later, when I say 5-6 years later, I went to China and traveled. This is apropos of working toward, of not knowing what you're writing when you're writing it. So I wrote Riding the Iron Rooster. And based on the idea that I would take every train in China, I went from London and through Germany, then Poland to Mongolia. I went to Datong, Beijing, Shanghai, all around. I went to far western China, southern China, southwestern China, Kunming, Guilin, Hong Kong. I went back up and down. I went to Harbin and the north in the bitter cold. And what I kept coming across was intransigent Chinese authority. At that time, there was a man called Fang Lizhe who was organizing protests. Every time there was a protest, the police came in and beat people on the head. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Every time someone puts up a sign, the government tears it down. When there's a demonstration, they put it down with ruthless ferocity. But I thought, I don't know what this is all about. Because they're also, by then, the Chinese were putting up, there were 3 hotels in Shanghai, but I saw that they were putting up 6 more. And I said to an American there, what is the story with this? Did you think that this was going to happen? And what's going to happen next? He said, we had no idea that this was going to happen. So we have no idea. We never saw this. And so we can't imagine what's going to come. And you know what came, which is they're now the manufacturer for the world. When the book was published, though, it was very severely criticized. And I was seen as negative, grumpy, curmudgeonly. And people saying, how could I say such awful things about the Chinese? They're our friends. They're modernizing. And why am I negative? And what I had talked about was just the way the government had an iron fist on just on the mildest thing, whether someone smoking in a bus, he was punished. Put up a sign or the Fang Lizhe democracy movement, put down with ruthless ferocity. So 1988, the book was published. You could look at the reviews. You could look at the review in the New York Times, which was memorably vicious and saying, this book is misinformed and blah, blah, blah. I have a lot of Chinese friends. They're not like this. Okay, fine. Well, you can't generalize about a country. But the next year, in June 1989, there was a Tiananmen Square incident, and it was put down. It was dealt with in exactly the way I had described, without knowing what I was describing. I was just describing a tendency. And the tendency was utter intolerance, a political intolerance. And so the book looked prescient. So I began to think that if you tell the truth about a place, in spite of what anyone says about it, people criticize you, they say, you shouldn't say these things, this is wrong. Not that it's politically incorrect, but I've got a lot of friends like that, this is wrong. You say, no, I saw this. I'm going to record what I saw. I don't know what it adds up to, but this is what I saw. This is what I heard. This is what people told me. And you walk around a country, you take a train or a bus, you don't fly, but you see and write things down. And if you are truthful, then the truth seems prescient. But if you're very truthful about a place, the truth is prophetic. So you don't know what it adds up to until time passes and you say, ah, yes, that's what I was describing. I was describing this tendency, no matter what the tendency is. In my case, I'm just a travel writer. People say, what do you do? I'm just grinning like a dog and wandering the streets and writing down what I hear or see. But sometimes without knowing it, without being conscious of it, you're building up a picture which in times becomes a kind of prophetic thing. And I felt Naipaul did that, Dickens did it, Trollope did it. All the really good travel writers or travelers recorded something which has a historical dimension, which really matters. There's a writer, Wilfred Thesiger. Do you know what I mean by Wilfred Thesiger? He wrote Arabian Sands, but he also wrote The Marsh Arabs. Now, today, the Marsh Arabs don't exist. They lived in the marshes in southern Iraq. They lived on reed islands. They built reed houses. They went about in reed boats. Wilfred Thesiger just got up. He spoke Arabic, and he lived with them, and he described them. He just thought it's a group of people cut off from others and a completely sort of hermetic, well-organized, coherent community in the water, in the Shatt al-Arab waterway. So, and in the marshes of southern Iraq. Well, the book is excellent, and you read it, and you think, the life of these people has never been described. Thesiger visited them a lot, talked to people, told their story. And then when Saddam Hussein got the bee in his bonnet, I think the people were regarded as disloyal. He drained the marshes, it relocated the people, and they don't exist. And then, of course, there's the Iraq War, and they really don't exist. So Thesiger, although it was in the 1950s that he was describing, maybe early 60s, it doesn't exist anymore. I mean, these people are gone. So historically, that's a valuable thing. I described how I am describing a tendency. He's describing a way of life that's gone. So I've mentioned 5 books, maybe just in the past 10 minutes. What's a travel book? I have no idea what a travel book is. A travel book can be a jaunt, like, you know, someone taking a long trip. Eric Newby wrote A Short Walk in the Hindu Kush. He and a friend said, let's climb the Hindu Kush. And they go, and they actually meet Thesiger at the end of the book. In fact, Thesiger sees them. It's very rocky. He sees them blowing up an air mattress. And he says, what are you doing? He says, rocky ground. He says, you must be a couple of pansies. And why in that air mattress? And so that's a jaunt. Then there's a feat. There's someone who walking from Cape to Cairo, which has been done. Or there's a man called Gerard d'Aboville who rode a boat across the Pacific Ocean. And people have windsurfed in the Indian Ocean. And, you know, they've written books about it. Just a feat. And that becomes a travel book. There's travel books of which have a strong sense of place. There's Christ Stopped at Eboli by Carlo Levi. Do you know the book? I mean, Carlo Levi was banished by Mussolini to a small village in the south of Italy. And he was there for a couple of years and wrote about this village, which he sees it as almost prehistoric in attitudes and so forth, sense of place. There are so-called travel books about people who never left home. Emily Dickinson never left home and sort of disparaged travel writing. There are adventure stories. There's a famous one, maybe not so famous, story of a man called Felice Benuzzi wrote it. It's called No Picnic on Mount Kenya. It's an Italians in a prison camp in Kenya. They're bored stiff, and they say, "How can we relieve our boredom?" And Benuzzi says, "I know. Let's climb that mountain." So they make equipment. They break out of the prison camp. They leave a note. They climb Mount Kenya. They leave a note at the top of Mount Kenya. They come back to the prison camp and surrender. The book is great, and the camp commandant is so impressed, he gives them very mild punishment. Heinrich Harrer, who wrote 7 Years in Tibet, also broke out of a prison camp. Travel books are about trespassing. In a way, all travel is a form of trespassing. When I wrote my book about the Pacific, I felt I was always trespassing because people on islands always see someone coming ashore as trouble. What could you, And the usual question is, how long are you going to stay? Or what are you doing here? Who do you know here? Do you have a family here? Do you really want to be here? So there's sort of paranoia and xenophobia, but understandably about someone living on an island, because what could you possibly contribute? And on an island, all land is accounted for. So that's another sort of travel book too, which is the trespassing book. One, apart from my own, which I was trespassing all over the Pacific, Werner Herzog, the filmmaker, wrote a very good book about walking from Munich to Paris. He had, like Bruce Chatwin, he had a mystical view of walking. And a woman film director was in the hospital in Paris, and he said to himself, if I walk to Paris, as long as I'm walking, she'll stay alive. So he walked from Munich to Paris and trespassed the whole way. Instead of staying in hotels, he broke into holiday houses. He'd find an empty house, break in, sleep on the floor, and then the next day leave and walk. Rather a weird concept of traveling, but walking, just walking through snow and ice and sleeping under trees or in abandoned houses, or in some cases not abandoned. And he got there, and the woman was still alive. So walking is another way of finding out how a country operates. And walking occupy, some of my favorite books are about walking. William Wordsworth, the poet, is said to have walked 180,000 miles in his life. And when he was 70, he climbed Mount Helvellyn. Henry David Thoreau writes about walking, and Rousseau wrote a book called Reveries of a Solitary Walker. Walking is also like a pilgrimage. So that's another, just the walking book is often a pilgrimage book. There's a famous Japanese book called Narrow Roads to the Great North by Basho. 13th century book, I think. Maybe 13th or 14th. And so there's the pilgrimage, there's the quest, there's trespassing, there's feet, there's the jaunt. There's the, you know, the sort of thing that I do. There's the adventure, there's social comment like Dickens. There's my favorite of all, I suppose, are the books about an ordeal. I'm sure you might even relate to this, that there's nothing like sitting at home, smoking a pipe. Well, maybe you're not smoking a pipe these days, but having a cup of coffee with a book in your hand, reading about someone really suffering, in you know, eating chocolates, and you're reading about someone, say the book, The Worst Journey in the World, the one about the South Pole, I mentioned Captain Scott, where it's written by an Englishman, Apsley Cherry Garrard. And Cherry, there's a good biography of him, went with two other men to find the rookery of the Emperor Penguin. There was a film called The March of the Penguins. He wasn't mentioned in it, but the first eggs of the Emperor Penguin were found by this man. And they can only be found in the middle of winter, where it's pitch dark, it's dark all day, and extremely cold. In Fahrenheit, minus 79. In fact, he says it's so cold, there's no point even in recording it. He was in the First World War, this man, and he said, the Battle of the Somme was a picnic compared to his experiences in the South Pole. But the book is fantastic. I mean, and so you read it, it's a book, a story of survival and meeting the challenges of daily life, faced with starvation. Thesiger had the same thing. Thirst, hunger, very bad cold in the case of the Worst Journey. In Thesiger's Arabian Sands, it's heat. But so when you read about an ordeal, it's not just a travel book, but you're reading a metaphor for how life can be and what a human response can be to adversity. You meet it and you say, well, how do they figure it out? How do they live? Well, you're reading a travel book, and in a way you're also reading about how people overcome the worst problems on earth. I knew Gerard Dabovie, who rode across the Pacific, and he told me, I said, what possessed you to get in a boat in Japan and row east, where there are, across the North Pacific, where there are no islands, where there's very big swells, very bad weather at times. He left late in the season. And then he arrived on the Oregon coast in a terrible storm. The boat was, it was a well-made boat, but it was rolling over. He almost drowned. It was a very long, very difficult trip. And he said, I wanted to do something that only a human being would do, that an animal wouldn't do. An animal tries to keep warm. It tries to find food. It curls up under a tree. That's what animals do. But a human being should be able to do something a little bigger than that. I want to think, he said, I wanted to think about what a human being might be capable of. And I wanted to do something that wasn't useful. He said, everything, you know, animals do useful things. They go and they, you know, they find nuts from a tree, or they eat flowers, or chase your cat, or whatever it is. But he said, I wanted to do something that wasn't useful. So that's, if I had to choose my favorite kind of travel book, it would be The Ordeal. Okay, so, but you see how many categories I'm talking about: the feat, ordeal, adventure, social comment. And so with that in mind, I thought, people used to say, what's your favorite book? This is the age of lists. Your five favorite films, your 10 favorite restaurants, the, you know, five favorite beer types of beer, 10 cheeses you couldn't live without. So, but that, you know, life isn't like that. Life is more about 50 cheeses you couldn't live without, and 50 places you'd like to go, and a lot of friends and a lot of books. So I thought, I want to write a book. I want to edit and personally introduce and describe my favorite books and my favorite topics in travel. Something that really interests me about travel is, how long did a traveler travel for? D.H. Lawrence wrote a book called Sea and Sardinia. Has anyone read it? Sea and Sardinia. He went to Sardinia. I don't see any hands going up, but I assure you, it's kind of an interesting book. He was in Sardinia for 1 week. Maybe that's why you didn't read it. He 1 week. He went with his wife, Frieda, Frieda von Richthofen. Her cousin was the Red Baron. So how long did the traveler? Ibn Battuta, the great Moroccan traveler, traveled for 26 years. Marco Polo was away for about 26, 27 years. Graham Greene was in Africa, wrote a book about Liberia. It's like Heart of Darkness. He was there for 18 days. Well, you've been to Africa for 18 days. And, you know, who hasn't been in Africa for 18 days? Well, some people maybe, but Green, it's sort of the defining, for some people, a defining travel book. And it is, of course, an excellent book. But some people travel for 2 months, some for 3 months, some for a year. Stanley took 3 years to go through Africa. So one of the topics is, how long did people travel? What did they eat? What did they take with them? What about their fears and their neuroses? I mentioned Captain Scott cried easily. Dr. Johnson went to Scotland. He had Tourette's syndrome. David Livingstone was looking for the source of, well, he went up the Zambezi River. He was actually, among other things, looking for the source of the Nile and trying to make converts. By the way, David Livingstone made one convert in Africa. He converted one person to Christianity. And the person changed his mind about a year later. He was very depressive. A lot of travelers have some sort of mental challenge. Vancouver, Captain Vancouver, who sailed the Pacific and the Pacific Northwest, was very depressive. So when he got very, very depressed, sometimes he'd see a headland or something and he'd give it a name, and you could tell what mood he was in, because some he'd called Cape Hope, and there's a place called Desolation Sound. So Captain Vancouver, on a very, very bad day, said, I'll call that Desolation Sound. So I talk about being a stranger, about staying home, about imaginary journeys, about some people write about places they've never been. You know me, I mean by Saul Bellow. Saul Bellow wrote a book called Henderson the Rain King. You read the book, and if you haven't been to Africa, it's an amazingly good book. If you've been to Africa, you say, this thing is a comic book. Bellow had never been to Africa. So in when you read it, you think he hasn't. The Tarzan books by Edgar Rice Burroughs were written by a man who had never been to Africa, but they're somewhat convincing until you go to Africa. Franz Kafka wrote a book called America. May have come across it. And you think, this isn't, you know, if you've never been to America, you think, gosh, this is kind of interesting. A guy leaves Germany and goes to America. He goes to New York and then goes to Boston, except that when he goes from New York to Boston, he's on a bridge. He's on a bridge that connects New York to Boston. A bridge? Such a bridge doesn't exist. So, there's food. People say to me, you must have eaten some strange things. Well, yes and no. But food is always mentioned in travel books. And so I have a section here called Everything is Edible Somewhere. No matter what it is, someone eats it. And I was in China. Someone offered me an owl. He held an owl in a cage and said, do you want to eat it? I said, yeah, all right. How much? He said, so I gave him the money and I got the owl. I said, I want to look at it. So I took the owl and I let him go. He said, what are you doing? We were going to cook him. I said, no, I think I, and he flew away. I thought, this is wonderful. Strange meals. So it's a compendium of that sort of thing. And then I have what I consider to be, and I'll close on this note, the essential Tao of travel. So all these topics, but what does it add up to? 10 rules. One is leave home. My mother, when I was growing up, used to say, play outside. If someone said, how did you become a traveler? I think it was my mother saying, play outside. I come from a family of 7 children. She said, go outside, go outside. Well, you don't just go outside and hang around. You go outside and you go further and further away. So my mother saying, play outside was quite a good lesson. Leaving home is essential. Go alone, travel light, bring a map, go by land. Flying isn't really travel. It's sort of transferring to a place. The travel begins when you arrive. Walk across a national frontier. Just crossing a border. It doesn't matter. It could be Holland to Belgium. It could be Mongolia into China. It could be Ethiopia into Kenya. Wherever it is, walking across. It's a very vivid and somewhat metaphysical experience. Write down your thoughts. Keep a journal. Read a novel that has no relation to the place that you're in. I say, so you're going to Alaska, you know what you should read? They say, yeah, what? Madame Bovary. They say, why? Well, a book like Madame Bovary, let's say. But if it's with Madame Bovary, because there's nothing like a novel to acquaint you with a character in an intimate way. We know characters in novels better than we know each other. The great thing about fiction, the great thing about the novel is that you understand a character in a novel so well, if the novelist is doing his job. So we really understand Madame Bovary, the lovers, her sneaking around. You may not admire her, but you have a sneaking sympathy for her, and you see she's getting deeper and deeper into debt, in love, and she's sort of caught, and you think, how is this going to end? So there's nothing at the end of the day in Alaska, you go up to your room and you're in France. And you're in a provincial town, you're in Yonville and reading about Madame Bovary. If you must bring a cell phone, avoid using it. And the last rule is make a friend. I feel that coming back to Amsterdam, I'm coming back to friends. Thank you very much.
That was Paul Theroux with the Tao of Travel back in 2011. Did you know that you can go to our website, john-adams.nl/videos, where there's a link to the video of this event, including an extensive Q&A session? While you're there, you can sign up for our newsletter or even become a member of the John Adams. You support what we do, you get a discount to future live events, everyone wins. In the meantime, you should go to wherever you get your podcasts and review this show. This will help get the word out. We can keep on sharing the very best of American thinkers with you, free of charge. That's it for this week's show. Our theme song is called La Prensa by the Parlandos. Our editor is Tracy Metz. From Amsterdam, this was Bright Minds, the podcast from the John Adams Institute. I'm Jonathan Gruber. Thank you for listening.